April is Fair Housing Month, which is a time to reflect on the progress made and the work that's still left to do. While the Fair Housing Act of 1968 was a landmark step in making housing discrimination illegal, the work of building a truly fair and inclusive city is far from over. Fair Housing Month is a reminder that access to housing is about more than just real estate. It's about justice, opportunity, and repairing past harm. For industry professionals, understanding the impact of housing policies and the gaps that remain is critical to building a more equitable city. Today we're joined by April DeSimone, founder of Publius. April explores how race, policy, and the built environment intersect, and what we can do to dismantle systemic barriers. Growing up in the Bronx, she saw firsthand how housing policies shaped her neighborhood, and now her work focuses on how thoughtful design can promote equity, healing, and justice. In this episode, we'll explore the impact of fair housing laws, the challenges that remain, and what the real estate industry must do to create a more inclusive future. April, thanks for being here. Let's get real about fair housing.
Let's get real. Thank you so much for having me here. It's such a pivotal moment in our climates to talk about what is fair in housing.
So I know your work is inspired and informed by your lived experience. Can you tell me about your background and what led to your interest in fair housing?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And I think it's those neighborhood blocks that when you're growing up in them really impressed upon you very early on the concept of home, the ecosystem of home, neighborhoods, going into shops, having relationships with the shop owners, that there was this street activity that gave you that concept and consciousness of what fair means, what unfairness means.
So you grew up in Tremont in the Bronx. And to give some historical context for those who may not know, entire blocks in Tremont in the 70s and 80s were lost to fires, many intentionally set, and countless people were displaced. Can you speak a little about the dramatic change and disinvestment that you saw in your neighborhood?
It's very interesting because your built environment tells you a story. And we always hear how our neighborhoods assign value and create value, right? We hear, what zip code are you from? And I think it's incredibly important to be aware that buildings tell us stories. As a, you know, with the background in design and doing the work I do, what we saw in places like a Tremont was once these intact ecologies, to see it become what today is one of the poorest congressional districts really impacts us and says, well, what happened here? How did it happen? What were the forces behind it? And I don't think it's only the concept of redlining, which is what prompted this need for things like a Fair Housing Act of 1968. I think it's this human perception or this psychology of value in the built environment. And I think Tremont was indicative of what was valuable and what wasn't valuable. And I think that that, again, we can say a redlining map that we all talk about now, but I think that psychology has really been a pushback and an indictment to American democracy from the inception of this nation's history of, if you have, you can live here. If you don't, you can't live here. But how does that translate then to the neighborhood block? And how does that thinking really begin to shape the social and the spatial dynamics of community over time?
You mentioned redlining. Can you talk a little bit about these policies and what their impact was?
I think it's the psychology of, again, disinvestment. So as we know, you know, redlining maps are the manifestation of a psychology that's been practiced for so long. But what made them different was that they were started by the federal government, these maps that then were used to infuse millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into America's infrastructure to put people back to work as a result to respond back to the Great Depression. And in doing so, it just concretized, again, how we were going to develop our neighborhoods. And when you have instruments that are making very clear where money was going to go based on who lived there and who didn't, and done by people who are put in positions of authority to steward the ideologies and principles of democracy, we all as a society bear costs to that. And when you start thinking of a place as not being of value, you let it devolve into what many of these communities became in spaces like the Bronx. And even in Tremont today, despite that devolvement, it's never gone back to the peak of what it was at, you know, during industrialization and to the 1960s, because the areas are still all sort of hollowed out. So it just tells you and it asks you why. What's fair about that? And don't we all deserve spaces to live healthy and have vibrant lives involved in, to evolve and to live?
The Fair Housing Act, which we mentioned was passed in 1968, was an attempt to reverse or begin to make amends for policies like redlining. What was its impact?
I think the intention was honorable under Lyndon Johnson's administration, and I think it was coming off of the heels of the assassination of MLK. So I think it was trying to say we need to move in a different direction as a nation if we honor and believe values like all men are created equal or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I think in theory, it presented this opportunity to raise a consciousness to say this is why we have to pass a federal act to ensure that discrimination doesn't occur. But at the same time, for people like me, if we live in a land of liberty and freedom, why do we need an act to begin with? So it's putting this juxtapositioning again in our consciousness to say, where were we that we needed these types of acts? And how has that act really reflected what the reality is in 2025? On the neighborhood composition, where we live, where we navigate to, do we think that we have achieved fair housing?
I think many would agree with you that no, we haven't achieved fair housing, which is why these laws are constantly in flux. Can you talk a little bit about what in this legislation has worked or maybe what hasn't over the years?
Again, my work brings me to the scale of a neighborhood block. I'm constantly navigating spaces across this country. And not to be a pessimist, I don't think a lot of what we have done has worked. And I'm being very honest about that. Because if it had worked, or it is working, we wouldn't have the conditions we continually see that are indicative of several generations over. I think we need more innovation in financing. I think we need to understand that it's not about building a unit, that unit operates in a greater ecosystem of home? And how do we address different typologies, not just an affordable housing unit, but how do we look at single family homes, the condition of those homes, multi-unit family homes? How do we create circulation in neighborhoods that make it desirable for all different people to live? And that's just what it is. It's housing for all, accessibility for all. We need to do that because I think that then would give more meaning to defining, not through rhetoric, but through actual practice, what fair housing could look like.
Regardless of flaws, I still think it's incredibly important that fair housing legislation exists at all. And I wonder if you could speak to that point.
Yeah, I think that, again, we live in a climate that we still reinforce a hierarchy of human value. So I think when that exists in our socio-spatial phenomena, we still need legislative action to create checks and balances. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have that yet, but I think then you have to take sort of the theory of the legislation and create the multiplicity of pathways to actualize it at the scale of a neighborhood block. And I think that sometimes there's a disconnect that we just look at one area and we don't look at the myriad of pathways that are going to be necessary for us to actualize the housing and neighborhoods and environments we all want to see. So you can have this piece of legislation, but the legislation is not matching to the reality or the lived realities of communities and people. And something has to be a bridge to that. And I'm excited at what that could be, because it would be amazing to live in a nation where, as we've heard before, we can uphold our creed and we can truly say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people without a legislation mandating you to want that for all.
So how do we get to the society that you're describing here? What are some alternative models?
It's interesting, you know, when we look at opportunities for housing, we are relegated 99% of the time to a rental conversation. And in order for really to build agency and people to have ownership, we need to come up with different models. I think limited equity co-ops are a huge opportunity to begin looking at, particularly as we're doing office conversions. It really gives this sense of groundedness and belonging because you don't have to own the whole thing, but you own a piece of something and you're building some equity over time versus just the rental conversation where rents will continue to just increase and people will never get a return. There's a rising movement around perpetual purpose trusts, which is what we're exploring. But how do we invite different typologies of housing that, again, meet the one size does not fit all need of households to say, here's how we can really restitch the block, given these histories that we have had, not about shaming or blaming, but really about healing and belonging. And who wouldn't want that?
Very interesting. I know you're using some of these models in your work. Can you explain a bit of just what you're doing, what you're looking at?
So we're always so busy with the NIMBYism conversation of moving into these established neighborhoods. Why can't we look at alternative neighborhoods where what the Bronx was, for example, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where we had this in-rem stock of land that was very cheap? How can we buy things when they're low and then build upon them and use the appreciated value to drive purpose and to drive reinvestment back into sustaining an 80% of the portfolio to do the impact through shared equity or cooperative ownership models, and then use the 20 to sustain it through traditional market rate sales and rentals. And I think that we need to pivot in that moment. And that's the work we're exploring is, you know, we know housing is, especially home ownership, is the vein of American democracy. We are realizing that more and more people, no matter how hard they're working, the American dream is becoming very elusive for them in the ability to own. I think it forces us to reevaluate. So how we're doing it is looking at it through a perpetual purpose trust, and how can we acquire assets that once we know the investment is there, it's not going to be affordable. So how can we do fractional ownership of a home that will then allow a family to stabilize over time, build some equity, and then move on and leave that opportunity for the next one? We need that recalibration in the market.
Especially now during Fair Housing Month, but all year long, why is it important that we have these conversations?
I think it's important because we're part of a greater society. And it's a greater society that's premised on a social contract of values. And I really believe that real estate has a direct correlation to reflecting how we practice those values. If we can come to a table and let the people who are willing to do that work not perpetuate a poverty narrative, but actually want to do the work through innovative approaches, why can't we cross-pollinate? Because we all win with that. And I don't think it's about just race. It's not about black and white, which is the premise, obviously, of the Fair Housing Act. It's something that scales far beyond that. It's about our shared humanity. And if we don't nurture and cultivate that as an industry, it's the physical manifestation of it. Where are we heading as a species?
So then looking ahead to the future, what can we do?
I think we're in a, it may seem that we're in a gloomy or in pessimistic moment. I just think it's a moment of opportunity. And I think we're in a moment now of what we want to see as we come upon the 250th anniversary of the founding of this nation. What do we want the next 250 years to look like? And we're in a moment that I think all of us in this space and beyond can really make a difference.
April, thank you. Real Talk NYC is produced by the Real Estate Board of New York. Today's episode was edited and hosted by Grace Boak with help from Jason Ryan. Thanks for listening.